Thank you for listening to the Coal Mine Podcast. This is David Cole in Dallas, Texas, and it's March 2024. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Dr. Ben Voth, a professor of rhetoric and the director of debate and speech at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. We're talking about scholarly work that he's done about James Farmer, an important but at times underappreciated leader of the civil rights movement. A subject of the movie The Great Debaters, Mr. Farmer's work is a powerful example of what debate training can accomplish, and my hope is that we can learn something from it for our time. Guest today is Dr. Ben Voth, a professor at SMU, who I've known since high school, college. It's been many, many, many years.
Dave, it's great to be here with you today.
One of the areas that Ben has studied in recent years in his work in rhetoric is the story of James Farmer of East Texas. And that's what I wanted to talk to Ben about today. So, Ben, thanks for being with me today as my guest. Tell me a little about who is Dr. Farmer and how did you come to be interested in his life story and what we can learn from it?
Thanks, David. James Farmer Jr. is arguably the largely unknown architect of the American Civil Rights Movement. Pretty much everything that we popularly attribute to Martin Luther King, and honestly, in a right way, Martin Luther King was a very profound and important figure to American civil rights, but the predicates of what he did, by King's own testimony, come from James Farmer Jr., who is someone who was born here in Texas, Marshall, Texas, in 1920, and really by 1941 and 1942 had formed in his mind, after graduating from college, the goal of abolishing anti-black segregation in the United States. And so I put in the book this famous story in my mind where his dad, who actually was the first black PhD in the state of Texas, after he graduated both from Wiley College here in Texas and Howard University in Washington, D.C., his dad said, "What do you want to do with your education?" And James Farmer Jr. said, "Destroy segregation." And there's clear historical record from 1941 onward that he really is the chief architect. And then the things that King does in the 1950s and 1960s, those come later. And just to kind of connect with your second question about, like, how did I get interested in this? When the movie by Denzel Washington came out in 2007, 2008, and you probably remember it, some of your listeners can probably remember it, Washington created this great movie called The Great Debaters. And it mainly focuses, again, rightly, upon an incredible historical story based at Wiley College in Marshall, Texas, of a debate coach named Melvin Tolson, who in the 1930s led a debate team to have probably one of the first integrated debates between black debaters and white debaters, actually in Oklahoma City and even ultimately USC. Although the film kind of renders that, and you'll appreciate this, David, as being with Harvard, that's just kind of some literary license. But that film in 2008 really illuminated that history and made me want to dig deeper. And really, I wrote a book in 2017 that really takes up where the film leaves off and kind of helps you understand what did Farmer do to destroy segregation in the United States between 1941 and 1967. And really, it's a pretty incredible story.
It's just astonishing to me in reviewing some of your work and visiting with you how he was, as a young man, so firm in his conviction, his plan for the future in 1941, Texas. I mean, that was a long time ago in a very, very different society. That really took a lot of self-confidence.
And it's interesting when you get into the details of it, and this is alluded to in the film that Denzel Washington created. He did, James Farmer Jr. did witness lynchings in Texas in the 1930s when he was on the debate team. As they would travel to tournaments, they would at night encounter really horrific things. And really the idea of challenging racial segregation in 1941, it's really startling, and it shocked me as well. I kind of always thought that things sort of start with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in 1963, and that's where things really get going, or maybe Rosa Parks not giving up her seat on the bus in 1954. I didn't realize that really 15, 20 years before the conventional starts, there really was a very aggressive and successful effort to start, and really the first sit-in in Chicago in 1942 was a really important starting point that we can now see.
We moved from 1941 and him telling his dad, "I'm going to take on the world." And then he did, is what I learned from your work. 1942, he's taking affirmative steps. And you just mentioned that in this
sit-in in Chicago. Tell me about that. I thought that was a fascinating story. One thing, it's on the other side of the world from Washington and Texas. I'm not entirely sure how he got there. But then once he got there, he didn't sit around. He got rolling.
At that graduation event that I said, you know, where he told his dad, like, hey, I'm not going to go into the Methodist ministry, but rather I'm going to destroy segregation in the United States. His dad actually gave him $500 to kind of bring him for a few months. And he made the decision to go to Chicago and start collaborating with a guy named George Hauser. And he was a kind of white intellectual in the Chicago area. And then they got into collaboration with students at the University of Chicago. And again, for me, working in a college environment, it's really neat how college students become a really important part of this group that they created called the Congress of Racial Equality. So CORE is the acronym. And that group did stage the first nonviolent direct action sit-in at a restaurant called Jack Sprat, where the owner had just kind of incidentally refused, when George Hauser and James Farmer were visiting his store, refused to let him have a donut. And the two of them kind of conspired, like, hey, they said, we owe it to this man's religion to kind of straighten this out. So they came up with this plan to bring integrated college students into this shop. And they even told the police about it in advance. And when the police were called, the police ultimately ended up telling the owner, look, stop calling us. Our advice to you is to serve these guests and stop trying to get us involved in something that's just your personal preference. And so it indicated, especially for me as a debate coach, an unusual perseverance and idealism, and also the power of dialogue, of really talking to people about why do they hold a prejudice, and having this ideal view that can change somebody's mind. And I think that was, for me, the big revolutionary conclusion of studying the entire life of James Farmer.
Where does he go from there? What activities do he and his organization or begin to take up after that first successful effort?
So it's really interesting. And again, they borrowed these principles of nonviolence, and they had very specific plans. They actually came from Gandhi in India. And even though there were a lot of Christian groups involved, the CORE was a secular group that followed these very specific principles. And they would go to skating rinks, pools, restaurants, and they would stage very careful events. And this group grew from about 12 or 20 people in the first year to, by 1964, they had over 80,000 members nationwide. And so, for example, in one incident in Denver, a local Denver CORE chapter, they were interviewing a restaurant owner, and I found this in the archives here at the University of Texas, Austin. Hey, why are you segregating? Why are you not allowing black patrons to be seated? And she said, well, I personally would like to serve black residents here in Denver, but I don't think my other patrons would appreciate that, so I defer to their preferences. And CORE responded by saying, would you mind if we interviewed your patrons politely to find out their feelings on this matter? And she said, sure, that would be fine. They surveyed the patrons, and as you might guess, they found that actually that the patrons would prefer an integrated service pattern at the restaurant. And the owner, after seeing the data, said, oh, okay, well, then I'm going to change my policy and we're going to become an integrated restaurant. And when you really dig into the details from 1942 to like 1954, where we get like Brown versus Board, we get some really dramatic federal interventions, I realized that in those dozen years, there really were these profound rhetorical interactions where many people gave up their segregationist policies in St. Louis, Minneapolis, Chicago, Denver, all across the United States. There were many, many successes that were achieved in a private realm of negotiation, rooted in the idealism of debate practice, that you can peacefully argue with another person and change their mind and change the practices. And so when I was digging through the archives at UT Austin, I was just shocked. Just page upon page, you know, example upon example, all predating the really classic federal struggles, which I think are important, but may leave us sort of feeling like we only can solve problems with the heavy hammer of like a federal law or Supreme Court opinion.
Did Mr. Farmer ever meet Gandhi? Did they ever have a chance to speak in person?
Now, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure. I think that might have happened. I can tell you this, that the real critical linchpin between the two groups is a book called War Without Violence, written in 1937 by a U.S. Christian missionary who went to India and worked with and for Gandhi, and out of years of experience with that, compiled this book that became a pretty popular global book on how do you resolve conflict. And when you open that book, there are these 13 rules that he discerned Gandhi to be implementing there in India. And you can see very clearly rhetorically that what Kaur adopts in their 12 rules is almost word for word the same as Gandhi. And so, you know, I've had some Indian colleagues here in the United States who've been very fascinated by this, that there really are Indian foundations to the American civil rights movement. And that's where I always try to make the point. There's a really powerful ecumenical dimension to Farmer's work because there's Hindu influences. There's actually Muslim influences from Malcolm X. There's Jewish influence from some of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman. Schwerner and Goodman were Jewish activists killed in Freedom Summer 1964. So there's a bunch of different religious groups cooperating under this broad umbrella of nonviolence. But really, the inception is very clearly with God.
Is it Dr. Farmer or Mr. Farmer?
He got a Master's of Divinity degree at Howard, but I don't think it went further than that. Now, the Dr. Farmer is his dad, and his dad was the Blatt PhD and spoke seven languages. And so I think and by the way, he's also depicted in the film with Denzel Washington. But technically, yeah, James Farmer would just probably be Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Farmer's father is no small character. He had extraordinary achievement in academics in a time when he was probably not welcome in many academic circles.
Yes, and I think, again, the film that Denzel Washington made does a good job of conveying that. I always like to say to undergraduate students that because they were both contemporaries and actually debate opponents, I like to draw a contrast between Malcolm X and James Farmer. Malcolm X, unfortunately, his dad was killed when he was at the age of 3, and that really colored his thinking on race relations and his pessimistic outlook on what was possible between blacks and whites in the United States. Conversely, James Farmer Jr. had a dad who really was like a god across the United States. He was called upon by multiple HBCUs to kind of lead different academic departments. And so I think that caused James Farmer Jr. to think really anything was possible. His idealism was deepened by the reality of a dad who was sought after, and even in a deeply segregated world, was able to navigate at higher levels than most black people would have enjoyed in the 1930s and 1940s.
He heads into the lion's den in the 60s, was part of the Freedom Rider movement, the effort to force desegregation, interstate busing. And that was a hard-fought struggle and a dangerous struggle by any measure. Tell me a little about that.
So I think one of the most provocative things that James Farmer Jr. led was the Freedom Rise of 1961. And there again, the unusually patient rhetorical means of the movement were quite evident, where in April, he sent a letter to John F. Kennedy just politely explaining, hey, we're going to have two buses. They're going to leave Washington, D.C. They're going to travel to New Orleans. We're going to ride these buses in an integrated fashion. They're going to abide the 1961 Supreme Court decision that says that the South is not allowed to create these segregated conditions at bus stops and on interstate bus travel. So we're going to check and make sure that this is going to work as promised by the Supreme Court. Now, the letter kind of betrays a fundamental understanding that even though this is now the second Supreme Court decision, there was one in 1947 that said the same thing, Kennedy and everybody knows that this is going to result in violence. And in fact, most of the civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King, told Farmer, look, we appreciate your point, but this is too dangerous. Don't do it. And in fact, the buses did leave. They had John Lewis on board, who later becomes a U.S. congressional member, and he becomes famous, John Lewis, for being bloodied at Rock Hill, South Carolina, where kind of some white hooligans attack Lewis as one of the Freedom Riders. But they're invited to dinner by Martin Luther King in Atlanta, And when they sit down to dinner, King's very polite. But again, he says, y'all have done great. You've gotten all the way from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta, and nothing too terrible has happened. But as you all leave Atlanta here and you head into Alabama and Mississippi, it is far too dangerous. So I would just ask this evening that you stop this Freedom Ride. This is a good place to stop here at Atlanta. I'd like to ask you, what do you think the Freedom Rider said when he offered that? And we know from history that they turned him down. But not only that, they said to King, not only are we not going to stop, but we would like you to get on the bus with us, Dr. King. And that was pretty shrewd. But King said, no thanks, I'll choose my own Golgotha. He refused and also didn't pay for dinner that night, by the way. Farmer had to pay the dinner tab. And the other rather incredible thing historically is that that night, Farmer received a phone call from the hospital in Washington, D.C., where his dad was, and received news that his dad had died. And Farmer's mother insisted to the end of her life that the dad, who had the itinerary in hand at the hospital, willed himself to die that night because he wanted to pull his son off the bus. And that did, in fact, happen. Farmer went back to D.C. that night, and then the bus is rolled into Anniston, Alabama. And that's where the history is made. If you've ever seen the famous photos of the bus burning at Anniston, Alabama, it's a Freedom Ride bus. But incredibly, James Farmer was not on it. And it was terrorism in the United States on Mother's Day Sunday. It's a really sad chapter in American history where people literally came out of church with their children and then firebombed a bus with integrated black and white riders. There are some great documentaries that have been done about this, a lot of great books that have been written about this, but it's probably the bravest single act. And Farmer, in his own biography, said that his proudest achievement of the civil rights movement, of which he could claim many things, was in November of 1961, the Kennedy administration issued orders of finalizing interstate bus travel that would tear down the signs and the segregated fixtures. And so that was a very important but dangerous step. It's interesting that a woman named Diane Nash kind of comes from Nashville and rescues the Freedom Rides that kind of make a crisis point there in Alabama as they start to arrest Freedom Riders. And James Farmer returns to the scene and he explains to Diane Nash, like, you know, I'd love to have the help of these college students, but you all could be killed in this endeavor. And she says, I understand that, but we have to make sure that these Freedom Rides go on. And so they persevere because of a very young Diane Nash who kind of comes to the side of James Farmer Jr. So that episode in 1961 certainly was one of the most uniquely dangerous and yet ultimately successful. It definitely forced some paradoxes upon Bobby Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy was the attorney general, and he asked Farmer specifically, hey, could you guys just cool off and give this arrest? And Farmer famously responded on the phone to Bobby Kennedy, we've been cooling off for 300 years. And so, and which that line is borrowed by King later in some other interviews. So that 1961 Freedom Ride certainly was one of the most dramatic challenges of the agenda to abolish segregation in the United States by Farmer.
In our conversation earlier, we mentioned the 63 March on Washington, Dr. King's famous speech. Farmer wasn't there. I didn't appreciate that until I read some of your work. Tell me about that. I thought that was a fascinating little bit of background to that whole event and its significance.
Farmer was a very key player through the 1950s about when there would someday be a march on Washington. And they were actually, the civil rights leaders, A. Philip Randolph and others, were concerned about what was the right time. And so the summer of 1963 was thought to be the best time to do that. They created a program that would have 16 speakers. They already knew that King was a very effective public speaker, and so they had him slated to be speaker number 16. Right in the middle of the program, you can see James Farmer's name. He was going to speak in the middle of the program, but in fact, he was jailed about a week before the event in Bogalusa, Louisiana, for doing just what we're talking about, which was joining in a local protest against segregation. He had been jailed, and he made the rather dramatic decision that the civil rights leaders offered to bail him out of jail, but he said, no, if we're not going to bail everybody out of jail, I'm going to stay here with these other people who are fighting for a just cause. And he actually watched the event from a jail cell with a TV kind of outside the bars. And he said that when he saw King's speech, he knew he kind of had made a mistake and that he probably should have gone to the movement, that it was going to prove to be incredibly historic. But it does speak to the principles of the man and the advocate that, and I personally like to believe that when King delivers the line in I Have a Dream, where he says, "Some of you have come from narrow jail cells to be here today," that he is alluding in some sense to the very specific case of Farmer, which he would have been aware of, and maybe even hoping that at some last minute that Farmer would show up.
Malcolm X seemed very interested in hearing from Mr. Farmer, spending time with him. And as you point out, the relationship was so strong that Mr. Farmer was really the only major mainstream civil rights figure that came to Malcolm X's funeral. Tell me some more about that relationship.
Great question, because I think the relationship between James Farmer and Malcolm X can shed a lot of light here in the 21st century. And it is true that James Farmer really was the only major of the big four civil rights leaders who was willing to indulge Malcolm X's passion for public debate. Malcolm X's life was literally revolutionized by a college debate program coming into a prison to teach him debate. And Malcolm X famously said, after being trained in debate, I was gone on debating. And it definitely formed Malcolm X's new identity as a powerful public advocate. But he was considered so fearsome by the other civil rights leaders that they didn't want to legitimize his views. And so, for example, he referred to the March on Washington that we were just talking about as the farce on Washington. Like, he really thought it was too mild, too moderate, too ill-conceived to really overcome the dangers of segregation. But Malcolm X and James Farmer Jr. debated four times. I have a transcript of a debate they did at Cornell University in 1962 that actually contained some pretty interesting tidbits about the Freedom Rides in 1961. In that debate, Malcolm X makes fun of the fact that James Farmer was married to a white woman, something that was not well accepted by either the black or the white community. And yet, the debate relationship made the two men friends. And I think that's sort of the irony that's sort of important now. And it does contribute ultimately to Malcolm X's moderation in 1964, where he sent a postcard after performing the Hajj, where he traveled to Mecca. And he had been ill-informed that only black people actually worship Allah. When he got to Mecca, he could see plainly that there was a great variety of integrated faces at Mecca. And so he wrote back to James Farmer Jr. saying, "Hey, I need to talk to you about some of my fundamental presuppositions and see what else we can do differently going forward." And that really does become an important catalyst to the assassination of Malcolm X in 1965. But the close friendship with Farmer is really the guide into the more moderate Muslim program that Malcolm X tries to construct before February of 1965. We know that the friendship was very close, and it was really predicated on debate. The men liked debating with each other and really understood that they were mutual allies with different ideas about methodology.
I wanted to give people a sense of where you're coming from. What is your background academically?
Yeah, well, and so, of course, you know, you and I met on the high school debate circuit here in the Dallas area, and I've done debate since I was even in junior high here in the Dallas area. And while I was at Baylor, I kind of developed a passion for becoming a debate coach myself. I've been a debate coach at the collegiate level for about 30 years, and I really have fallen in love with what I think debate can do, both for the individual, but also for the society as a whole. And I've written six academic books. Most of them kind of focus on the idea that debate is transformative, not just for the individual, but for the future well-being of a society. And so even looking at places like Nigeria and Rwanda, trying to understand how debate can be magical and transformative has been important to me. And so I've gotten to be on the front row of the transformative activity of college and high school debate. And that's, you know, I want to give back in the way of being a coach and a director.
What are some takeaways that we today can try to incorporate in our dialogue today based on some of the things that you've seen and that we can learn from the life and the work of Mr. Farmer?
Yeah, no, it's a really important and good question. It was certainly a motive to me writing the James Farmer book in 2017, because I kind of saw that we were headed for some big impasses on these questions. And I do think that in 2024 we are at some impasses. And one of the contrasts that I try to set that I think is relevant is kind of a distinction that could be made between Afro-pessimism and Afro-idealism. And sort of the simple thing that I'm trying to draw attention to more and more, and I think James Farmer is a great representative of, is that, yes, black people can be and have been victims of anti-black racism, but many of them have done heroic things that have effectively reduced the harms of anti-black racism. And it's very important to understand those historical successes, not only just for the inherent value that they have historically, but actually as a methodology for future further progress. And I honestly believe that when you look at the rules that these core members follow, they're still very relevant to us today. For example, rule number one was get the facts first. And there actually were instances where CORE would investigate an allegation of racism and actually conclude that it wasn't a harm caused by racism, that there was some other reason that some bad result had happened. I think the other sort of hard thing that goes with this is recognizing that these hard-won triumphs that we talk about, like the 1964 Civil Rights Act or the 1965 Voting Rights Act, those successes came in circumstances that, quite frankly, were more challenging than they are for us today. We do face challenges about racism still today, but to not look to the successful models of the past and sort of dismiss them as somehow irrelevant or even worse, maybe that they were unsuccessful, I think is a terrible intellectual mistake. And so I think we still have a lot to learn from those black leaders who sacrificed more than most of us can ever imagine in order to bring us as far as we've come thus far. And I think those two parts are important to me, that there are practical rules that we can follow today in the way of dialogue to overcome our problems. And then secondly, to understand that there are people who've sacrificed more than we'll ever imagine, even to get us to the point of dialogue that we're at now, that is fraught with peril. And I recognize that.
As in James Farmer Jr.'s time, as a society, we face difficult challenges that are hard to talk about. I hope that this discussion with Dr. Ben Voth of SMU helped you learn more about Mr. Farmer and his approaches to the challenges of his time, and that he can inspire you as you think about how we will approach similar challenges in our own. For upcoming episodes, I anticipate further examination of some of these challenging issues as the terms of the United States and Texas Supreme Courts draw to a close. You can subscribe to this podcast on any of the main directories, and if you like it, I encourage you to join other happy listeners and leave a kind 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. I appreciate you listening, and I look forward to sharing with you again soon.